Hello, this is Dr. Karen Wyatt. I want to thank you again for being here for End of Life University. And our conversation today is titled Choices and Illusions at the End of Life. And my very special guest today is Eldon Taylor. Eldon has made a lifelong study of the human mind and has earned doctoral degrees in psychology and metaphysics. He is a fellow with the American Psychotherapy Association and a non-denominational minister. Eldon was a practicing criminalist for over 10 years while completing his education. He supervised and conducted investigations and testing to detect deception. His earliest work with changing inner beliefs was conducted from this setting, including a double-blind study conducted at the Utah State Prison. Eldon is president and director of Progressive Awareness Research Incorporated. He is also the inventor of the patented InnerTalk technology and has been called a master of the mind, specializing in both hypnosis and subliminal communication. For more than 20 years, his books, tapes, lectures, radio, and television appearances have approached personal empowerment from the cornerstone perspective of forgiveness, gratitude, self-responsibility, and service. Eldon now lives in the countryside of Washington State with his wife and their two sons. Apart from his family and work, his true passion is horses. Eldon, I would like to thank you so very much for being here with us today. I know this topic of end of life might be a little bit different than what you normally talk about, but your perspective is very important to us today. So thank you again for being here.
Indeed, it is my pleasure to join you. As you know, I am a great admirer of your work. I think you have written in your book, What Really Matters, a seminal piece that contributes greatly to assisting and facilitating people in dealing with not just the loss of a loved one, going through that process, but in preparation for, you know, bookends of life. The fact is, as you know, Karen, we come into the world, that being what we call our birth, and we will all leave this world at some point in time in something we term death. You can have all kinds of perspectives about that, but the one thing for certain, whenever you look at any and all of the spiritual systems, and whenever you look at the psychology of the human psyche, our failure to comprehend, process, and then integrate the pure fact that our lives are temporary, that we share this earth for but a very brief moment in the total of time, that to fail to integrate that will leave us living a life that's inauthentic.
I absolutely agree with that, but it sometimes puzzles me about why do we fail to integrate that? Why do so many people almost seem to have a belief that they will not die, or at least they cling to denial over that fact? I don't know if you have any insight into that.
Sure. You know, I mean, human psychology, such as Freud pointed out, we typically all have what's called a Thanatos urge. Which is, you know, the way we deny the fact that we are terminal. As Walt Whitman said, though our hearts are stout and brave, still like distant drums, they're beating funeral marches to the grave. The way we deny that is to sometimes dare to challenge it. So the Thanatos urge, which is, you know, I'm going to rappel down the mountain, I'm going to jump out of an airplane, I'm going to bungee cord off this bridge that will have me within 3 feet of the ground before it springs me back up. These kinds of daredevil things, they're what we carry out, demonstrating to ourselves that, you see, we're not as mortal as everybody thinks we are. We actually challenge that. And from a psychological standpoint, the people that might manipulate us, engineer our consent, are very well aware that we have this urge that we deny that becomes a part of our psychology and can be used to increase our threshold of arousal and thereby stimulate us to do a variety of different things. we as human beings do not want to accept the fact, just by nature, that our lives are short and that they mm-hmm. will at some point end. We do not want to get up and live that day as though it may be our last day. And part of that, you know, is species-oriented because our very survival depends on forward thinking. It depends on planning. It depends on, you know, we're squirrels, two-legged biped squirrels, if you want, that for all intent and purposes, we're planning for the future of our children when they go to college. We're planning, we're taking out 30-year mortgages. We're buying things in credit cards that maybe won't be paid off for 60 months. We live our lives in this mode of intention that has it perpetually putting off those end days, perpetually refusing to acknowledge that the day may come, and it may be very short. It could be 5 minutes from now that mm-hmm. you are going to be confronted with end of life. And of course, the lack of preparation creates its own problems when you approach that point in time as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what we've been talking about all week long in this series, are how people can be more prepared. And we've covered a lot of tangible things like having a will and an advance directive and, you know, being prepared for palliative or hospice care and talking to loved ones. But your area of expertise around beliefs is one that I think is also very important. And I read this in a blog that you wrote, what we believe forms the grid upon which our end-of-life story is built. And so I think that's something very important that we all need to address, our own beliefs about death and dying and the end of life, if we're truly going to be prepared for that time.
Well, as you know, Karen, I totally agree with you. And you and I have had the great opportunity of having conversations. You've been on my radio show, and I love your work and love your book, and I've recommended a lot of people get that. And we both are very aware of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her five stages, and we've discussed that before. And they have to do with mental attitude. But here's where what I think. You know, you can forget the stages altogether and just look at life this way. If, as Christopher Hitchens, you think, you know, this is it, from dust thou art to dust returneth, it gets to be a rather dismal approach when those final days come. And the pain seems to only grow more intense. And the need for amelioration of that pain, and therefore pharmacology, only increases. The research shows us that the patients who have a view of a life after death find that process of dying much easier than those patients who don't. But there are a couple of things that need to be added into that equation. When we approach those end days, it's very, you know, the things that start coming through our mind are first anger. You know, why now? Why me? I had all this that I... And the second thing that we begin to deal with is guilt and remorse. And we begin to process the things, perhaps, that we would like to do differently and the things that we haven't done. And that whole way of looking at life creates a sort of inner psychic torment. In advance of ever getting to that place, having ourselves to where each day we could look at the end of the day and say, if today were to be the day, it would have been one of the best days of my life. Having ourselves in that frame of psychology is where optimally we'd all like to be. Because when we're in that frame of psychology, the dying process per se is just it's another step in the process of life. I can remember, you know, being in a situation where I wanted to help someone who had just lost a dearly loved one, But because of restrictions, and you will relate to this, because of legal requirements, I really couldn't say anything to them about an afterlife, about a loved one maybe still being available on the other side, looking down on them, and all of the kind of counseling that you would do if you were a pastoral counselor. One of the reasons that I studied ministerial and pastoral counseling was simply because there comes the necessity pragmatically in our lives to look at life as having a greater picture. Look at life as being a process of learning, a schoolyard, if you will, that we have visited. The opportunity to pole vault, to taste chocolate, to ride horses, to do those things that enliven us, that we become passionate about, the favorite things. Give us the opportunity to laugh hard with our friends and to love hard with our families. You know, that's what life is. When we can look at life that way, then we can see another side, an afterlife. And in that process, passing becomes just, as I say, just another thing we do in our life. It's just another step in our lives. And when you have people, and I know you know this because you work with bereaved people and you work with hospice patients all the time, when you have a patient, a hospice patient, in that frame of mind, they're actually providing support to their loved ones who might be the ones otherwise in great grief and sorrow at the loss of their loved one. Our preparation for death is totally lacking in our culture, which is one of the reasons that your work is so important. We don't prepare our families for death. We avoid that kind of conversation with our children. It's natural for children to say, you know, to mom and dad, you know, what happens to me if you die? Oh, don't worry about that. I'm not going to die. You know, I can remember having triple bypass surgery about 6 years ago. And my youngest son at the time, he would have been 8, 9. My youngest son was terrified I would not come out of the hospital. And I told him, yeah, don't worry about it. I'll be home this weekend. You know, and I went on a Wednesday, and they did the surgery on Friday morning. And because I'd promised him I'd be home on the weekend, I checked myself out of the hospital on that Sunday because he was desperately concerned that something might happen and dad wouldn't. And that's very natural for children. But as parents, we tell them time and time again, it's not going to happen, don't worry. We lead them to believe that we'll live forever, as opposed to taking the time at the right age to have that conversation and to set things up. You know, I had great interest in this entire subject matter about 3 years ago, so I used my radio show to interview more than 24 of the brightest people out there in physics, in medicine, in the sciences, people that had experienced NDEs and written the books on, you know, near-death experiences and OBEs and the entire, in fact, your audiences could review all of these interviews because I put the best 24 up and you can see this past life research if you go to eldentaylor.com. But I put this research up after we did this entire 26, I guess it was, interviews. I was absolutely convinced that where we don't have a ghost in a bottle, the so-called corpse that we would have if we were investigating a homicide, where we don't have the independent, verifiable, objective, repeatable kind of study that we would have, we call a double blind in science, what we do have is more than enough anecdotal, more than enough firsthand, more than enough real evidence that if we were to take it into a court of law, and that was the whole premise, in a court of law, what would the average reasonable man conclude Was it the preponderance of evidence? We convict people every day on circumstantial evidence. We have far less to go on than what we have in life after death. And overwhelmingly, everyone agrees, the preponderance of evidence clearly says this is just a journey in the process of our lives. We don't really die. We really just cross over.
Mm-hmm. I so concur with everything that you're saying. And when you were talking about hospice patients having an easier time with passing at the end of life, if they do have a belief in the afterlife, I've told pretty much everyone I've interviewed this story that my own mother died in January of this year, and I got to take care of her at the end of life. But she had a very strong belief in an afterlife, and honestly, for the past few years, she was preparing herself and getting ready to die, and had no qualms and no fear about it whatsoever. It was we had lots of conversations, and she was able to tell my brother and I what she wanted and make plans. And even in those, you know, through each stage of the dying process, she was actually, there was a sense of joy and peace about her, and she kept telling me, I'm going home. And as you said, it totally lifted the burden from me being the caregiver for her to see how beautiful the process was that she was following.
You know, I guess there's a part of me that wants to say, I'm sorry for your loss, I remember. But then, mm-hmm. you know, your mother gave you a great gift. She gave you just a wonderful gift. And I think we should all work to give our families that same gift. But she gave herself a special gift as well. She took the time to I'm sure she did the basics. She didn't approach death full of guilt. She didn't approach death, you know, blaming lots of people or lots of things or God for you know, life sucks and then you die kinds of philosophies. And, you know, I'm sure she had done all of her forgiving. And I'm sure that she had lived a life where she was able to say to herself, my life made a difference. And, you know, one of the things that I work with all the time are people that have a very low sense of self-esteem. And so they're talking to themselves all the time. I can't do this. I'm not good enough for that. Or they self-sabotage their best efforts, or they're in, you know, jobs underperforming that they should be at a higher capacity. You know, they have greater capability than what they're expressing. That's the bottom line. And it's due to their own self-imposed belief that they're just not quite worthy, that they're just, you know. And so when you're working with these people with self-esteem, the first thing that I try and communicate to them is the best way to build esteem is from the inside. You know, it doesn't come from the outside. It isn't something that I can tell you, you know, you're a good person. You know, you have to begin to accept this yourself. You have to begin to believe that you have within you the capacity to believe in yourself more than you do. And I'm going to give you a tool to do that. And the tool I always give them, Karen, is service. It's what I consider one of the corners of my own four-corner philosophy that you mentioned when you introduced me. And to me, service is as simple as when people stop long enough to do a good deed for another person, they are hard to receive a reward. Let me say that again. I mean, I know you know this. You're a physician. The reward centers of the brain actually release positive neurochemicals, endorphins to the system. And those are the feel-good natural opiates, if you will, of the body. When we simply do something as elementary as writing a check to a charity that we care about. I can remember years ago, I had a client referred to me by a psychiatrist that was suicidal and had a history of self-mutilation. And I looked at her intake papers. She was outside in the lobby. I looked at her intake papers the first day she arrived, and I saw that her first healthcare provider was none other than Milton Erickson. And I honestly thought to myself, Karen, if Milton Erickson couldn't help this woman, what on earth? And I don't admit this casually, believe me, I'm ashamed of it. But at the time, I was also rather egotistically motivated to succeed. And so I didn't want a client that I couldn't succeed with. And this client had a history of healthcare professionals, and they had been unable to, you know, correct her problems. But epiphany, if you will, serendipity, synchronicity, visited me at that moment, and I had this idea, and I have shared this with many people since, and I share it in my book, Choices and Illusions. I share it with you now. It goes this way. When I did see her, I told her, look, I'm going to see you in what we call brief therapy. I'll see you for 10 weeks. It will be X day a week, and I expect you to be here on time, and you're going to have homework, and I set down the rules, and she agreed to all of that. So her homework was this. She was to get a journal, create a journal. I didn't care what it was, you know, how she did this. It could be writing on newspaper, but every day she was to go out of her way that first week to do one good deed for someone, anyone. Just go out of her way. And then that evening she was to write this good deed in her journal. Think about how it made the person feel. Think about how she felt doing it. Then close her eyes and go to bed. Just go to sleep on that idea, on that those memories. Week two, it was two. Week three, it was three. We took her up to five in week five, but she never really did five. But she could do two and three, and some of them weren't the greatest. But at the end of 10 weeks, she was off of most of her drugs, and I followed her. This was a change in her life. You know, when you're suicidal, when you're into self-mutilation, it's because you don't feel worthy. You don't feel deserving of living. I mean, you are really talking about some significant esteem issues. And she had, you know, understandable underlying reasons for this. But, you know, pure cognitive approaches should have been able to alleviate most of them. But her problem was she had never had the sense that she did anything with her life, that her life meant anything. I mean, listen, if she died tomorrow, no one would miss her. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
What happens when we go out there and we start helping other people is we get these warm, fuzzy feelings. You know, we begin to feel good about ourselves. We begin to see people respond to us differently. And if you want to build esteem, that's how you build esteem. And, you know, some people have said to me, Karen, they said, well, how would I go about doing that? I just never have any time. You know, I'm a plumber. I'm a mechanic. I'm a lawyer. I'm in court all day long. I'm a doctor. Okay? And here's the answer. With whatever you do, if you do it with service in mind first, you're there to help this person. This person matters. This person is the most important person. You treat them as though they were someone you really, really cared about, and you do your very best for them. You have provided the service. And in doing that, you know, the Bible says what you sow, you will reap. We get the same kind of stuff from Confucius, Lao Tse, and a number of others. The fact of the matter is, in doing that, you get really rewarded. You get rewarded not just with the great neurochemicals that strengthen your immune, your endocrine, and your ANS, but you get rewarded by the people that you're doing this service for. And if you happen to be in a business, you see your business prosper as well. When the time comes that you're going to be looking at end of life, and I think we should all begin looking at that, you know, as early as reasonable, and that probably is some point, you know, in our late teens or in our early 20s, we should be looking at our life and saying, you know, what does my life mean? What is the meaning of my life? What do I want it to be? What is my life purpose all about? And when we can establish that, then we can begin to prepare for how we transition from this life into the next life. Does that make any sense?
Oh, absolutely. And I love your story about working with your patient and having her be of service and practice doing something for others. And then it made me remember my own mom again, back to her story, but she was in very declining health for about 5 years. She wasn't really able to get out of the house the last 5 years of her life, and she was a woman who had always done a lot of volunteer work in our community, and it was distressing to her to lose that ability to get out of the house and do volunteer work.
Yeah.
But what she started doing instead was praying for people, and suddenly people would come into her life. She'd hear about someone from a friend over the phone, or she had neighbors that would stop by and tell her about something. And so she sat in her recliner chair at home, and she just prayed. She prayed all afternoon for various people. And that became her way of being of service. And then even in her last few weeks, I remember so clearly she told me, you know, my hospice nurse really needs me. I'm really working to help her. And I chuckled to myself because I thought how sweet that was, that she still had that focus that I'm here to serve other people, and that's what I do. And even in her last week of life, she was thinking about what can I do to help my nurse and my home health aide. And
what
epitomizes what you're describing.
Story.
Yeah.
And you know, what a wonderful woman she must have been, and what a great gift she left. That's a story I'll repeat if you give me permission to.
Absolutely. And it proves that we can all give something. As you said, it's the attitude of being of service
right.
that matters.
Yeah, I was looking at data going back into the 60s on intercessionary prayer. And even, you know, at a distance, and the data is really very robust there. I don't understand why there's, you know, there are articles that appear, and I pay attention to them, but they appear in skeptical publications that attack methodology, et cetera, some of these. But I'm not everyone that ever said that the fact is patients did improve that were in the prayer group and this and they didn't and they weren't receiving the so your mother, you know, your mother was doing more, much more, and I guess that's what I'm here to add here. I guess it's my left brain in my way sometimes. Your mother was doing much more than just praying, helping. So she's helping herself. She was really helping other people, and the hard numbers, that's a day that's exactly what you're not doing, and not just something make you feel good, but something that is very real as pushing a car down the street. That energy has been documented, great value that are prayed for.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the other things I love in your notion of it's never too late, that anyone can change up to the very last breath of life, and I find hope so hopeful. But I think it's really important for that, remember that even if we haven't lived our lives this way for all of our lives, there's still always hope. We can hope that we can change.
I totally agree with that. I concur with that. I mean, I really believe that. I have seen that in my own life. There are a number of documented stories out there of people in the very last minute do one good thing that changes the lives of thousands. One good thing, you know. To me, look, like I say, I'm a pragmatist. If I have 7 days and I have wasted all but 1 hour of those 7 days, but I do have that 1 hour, I can look at that 1 hour and I can waste it too, and then everything is a waste. Or I can look at it and make the best of that 1 hour. Now, this is what I do know. Mathematically, there are as many moments in the present as there are in eternity. In other words, they are infinite. So if what I do is I take that last 1 hour and I take every moment of that last 1 hour to dedicate it to making my life meaningful in some way, if it is in my head that I am going through and forgiving everyone that I've ever blamed, and I'm having imaginary conversations where I am really apologizing to people I have hurt, and I'm asking them to forgive me. If it is only in that process, what pragmatically happens is pain disappears, comfort levels increase, and I thereby have an hour of life that is optimal given the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And that's all it takes. All it takes is a moment for that transformation to take place.
You know, to cultivate positive emotions, we simply need a clear, accurate understanding of our own reality, and not just on a theoretical basis. And that means that we have to discern the fact that, you know, for all intent and purposes, happiness comes down to what did I do with my life and how do I feel about what I did. And the sooner we get that message, whether it's in that last hour or it's when I'm 20 years of age, the sooner we get that message, the better our lives will be right up and through the time that we make the transition.
Mm-hmm. And Eldon, a couple of times you've mentioned forgiveness, and I was curious to know if you have any tools that you recommend for people who need to practice forgiveness but are struggling with that.
You know, I'm glad you asked that question, because we do, and indeed, you know, a big change in my career came as a result of the prison study you mentioned, and back in the early 80s that we ran at the Utah State Prison. We used as an interdiction there a forgiveness program that had some positive self-esteem affirmations, but essentially I forgive myself, I am forgiven, I forgive all others. That was the boilerplating. The data from the prison system was really incredibly robust. We didn't just lower hostility and aggression, increase, you know, things like reflectivity, but it also... we could see an interruption in the recidivity rate. Very successful, cloned out to a number of prisons. In fact, I was giving a radio interview just a week and a half ago to a woman who was a psychologist at the facility, Chowchilla facility in California, and she says, I know we got your programs and we put it in there. So, but I took it from there and we used it with elite athletes who were having their own difficulties. You know, what a lot of people don't understand about forgiveness, and I don't mean to make this a very long story, but they don't understand that in forgiving, they're really setting themselves free. They're not setting somebody else free.
Mm-hmm.
There's two ways to be tied up in the world. You know, one is you could physically restrain me with ropes or chains or something. The other is I would attach a thread, say, to a doorknob, refuse to pull it hard enough to break it or to let go of it. And if I do that, well, I'm as effectively tied, tethered to that spot as I would be if you were to chain me there. Our beliefs can be these little strings that we just hang on to. And when we say, you know, well, there's nothing I could do about it, so-and-so, you know, when we displace responsibility through blame, we effectively rob ourselves of our own franchise. We should be able to proactively respond to every stimuli that comes to us in our lives. That's the one thing that we're in control of. I may not be in control of everything that I'm going to encounter in life, but I certainly should be in control of how I'm going to respond to it. And I should be responding not reactively, but in a proactive way. So if I'm doing that, if I'm living my life that way, then I have the opportunity to be authentic. I have the ability to choose differently. Let me share just a brief story, if I can.
Yes.
Imagine a person who has always wanted to go to New York. New York is, you know, it's the Big Apple. They've always wanted to see it. They're coming from far, far away. They've saved a lot of money so that they can experience New York. And the day comes that they arrive. This could be Paris or anywhere you want, but we'll stay with New York for the moment. So we're in New York, and it's an absolutely perfect day. It's just glorious. Even New Yorkers are saying, wow, I haven't seen a day like this in my lifetime. You can see forever. The temperature is perfect. It's just a light ocean breeze. It's just a beautiful, beautiful day. And, you know, our person gets to walking through the city. They decide they don't want any tours on this gorgeous day. They're not taking any cab rides. They're going to see it firsthand. And as they walk, they kind of meander away from the downtown area, and they find themselves in this exclusive condominium area, high-rise condominiums. And they're really in awe of the architecture, and even the sidewalks are stones that are perfectly matched and laid of opposite colors. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous area. And as they walk along, a flower pot falls from a third-story balcony and strikes them on the head. Now, the pot falls, continues to the sidewalk, the charge scatter about, da-da-da. You have some choices. The universe has just brought you a surprise. And typically, I've told this story to thousands, tens of thousands of people. Typically, I'm going to get one of three answers when I say, so what do you do? You know, what is it you do? Well, the first answer goes this way. You know, I'm going to take the charge of that pot. I'm taking it up to that third-story apartment and a condo. I'm knocking on the door and I'm putting them you know where. Okay? Of course, if you get up there and it's a lineman for the New York Giants, it's going to change your mind. The second one is, you know, look at this guy's pad. I mean, this is a fat cat. This is a really expensive area. I mean, you know, look, I got a bump on my head and an abrasion and it stings. But they don't know that. I mean, this could be whiplash. This could be concussion. Hey, I've got an opportunity. I mean, the insurance company will pay me off. This will never even get to court. I will get, you know, I'm going to make some money out of this, the opportunistic attitude. Now, at this point, I was telling this story. I have to share this with you, Karen, because I was telling this story to a radio DJ in Detroit. And at this point, he said, I'm going to do both, one and two. All right. So now that there's a third choice that people come up with, you know, and that choice, and forgive me, but I, you know, it's kind of the new age choice, you know. Choice goes this way. I am not going to let this situation ruin my day. This has just been an absolutely gorgeous day, and I'm not going to let it ruin my day. I'm just going to go on, experience the glory of this gorgeous day. I've saved for this all my life. Besides, the blow to my head may have rearranged a few neurons, and I'll experience a special state of enlightenment. Now, I think of that as denial, but that's okay, all right?
Yeah.
What else could you do? What else could you do? Because this is, you see, all three of those things are reactive. They're coming out of a pattern, and these are patterns, behavioral patterns, habits that you have had ascribed to you, literally as a result of your enculturation and the media that we live in, and so forth. But what else could you do? I mean, what happens if I pick up the flower? Because I don't want the flower to die. I take it to a florist. I have it repotted. And now, you know, look, I could take it home, but I really want to see what happens when I knock on the door of the owner and I tell him, you know, your flower pot fell from your balcony, hit me on the head. You probably should be careful not let it get quite so close to the edge. But I didn't want your flower to die, so I repotted. I really hope you like the pot I chose. And you hand it to him. Okay, now look, the end of the day, you put your head on the pillow. And you think about your day. Of those choices, which one's going to make you feel the best?
Yeah, absolutely, the last one.
Well, okay, now, I mean, you're the medical doctor. So
if I've got all this anger and hostility and aggression in me, what have I done besides interrupt the optimal operation of, you know, my endocrine and immune and ANS? I, you know, filled my system with catecholamines. You know, they're just going to help me age and experience dis-ease that I'm not going to like, right? On the other hand,
probably
when I have those...
increase my risk of heart disease.
Right. When I have those good feelings, what happens? Well, the reverse. The big three, they're promoted. Their wellness is... I have to add this. I have to share this. When I got home, you know, I came home early from this bypass surgery because of the fear of my son, but I wanted to recover really quickly. And because of the people I know and, you know, access that I have, I had all kinds of special equipment. And among that, I could monitor my heart and monitor it for coherent patterns. Not just with skip a beat or, you know, arrhythmia, et cetera, but for coherence itself. And I practiced different breathing exercises and things so that I could maintain coherence. And because I was limited to my physical activity, I found myself with my computer on my lap. And there's a game, a computer game. It's a chess game that I'd played many, many times before this and enjoyed. It's called Civilization. Sid Meier brought it out, and I think I was at that point playing Civilization 4. Well, the whole object with Civilization, for people that haven't played, is you build a culture from way back in the Stone Age. And, you know, you build wonders in the culture. These are real wonders. There's, you know, resources that you have to have as you progress. But if you progress far enough, you can build an America with, you know, jet aircraft and so on and so forth, all right? Do the space race. So now you have opposition in this game, and it's computer-generated opposition. And playing at the higher levels, you know, against these other countries, invariably they will declare war on you at some point. So you have to build armies, and then you end up going to war. Karen, every time a war occurred or that threat occurred in this game, I could not maintain coherence with my heart, no matter what I did. No breathing exercises, no anything. You know, since then, and I've shared this with cardiac people here where I live, but a lot of other people, since then I understand this. When you entertain these angry, nasty, get-even thoughts, you're not just, you know, affecting, as I say, your neurochemistry, you're actually affecting the coherent pattern of your heart. So you may think that, you know, well, this isn't bothering me at all, but just entertaining those thoughts, that entertaining that kind of ideation gives rise to interrupting the optimal operation of your body. Now listen, if you just want to be a pragmatist and you want to live long and healthy until the time comes to transition, it doesn't therefore make any sense for us to be blaming people. All right, full back around to your question. This forgiveness program, forgiving and letting go as we call it, I used with elite athletes, with Fortune 500 executives, with, you know, with everybody, truck drivers and plumbers and cowboys, rodeo cowboys. And we had some really great results with it. So I was out lecturing, telling everybody about it. And it's an InterTalk program. And it became our number one program. And then I had a dream. And in the dream, I was being lectured. If this is as important as you're telling everybody it is, how can you really charge them for them? Why aren't you giving it away? And at that point, this was about 17, 18 years ago, I said, well, okay, you know, you're right. I got up from the dream and I told my office it's free, and from here on in it's free, and it has been free for the past 18 years. You can get it free as a CD, but you have to pay the shipping, or you can download it free, and you just simply go to eldentaylor.com and choose free programs and forgiving and letting go and download that program. And it is a very powerful tool that facilitates change from the inside out. in how your psychology processes the need to blame someone else, and therefore it's very freeing. And as far as I'm concerned, that's where self-improvement of any kind begins. To the precise extent that you blame anyone for anything in your life, you're preparing yourself for some great disappointment in transitions, end of life, but you're also punishing yourself day in and day out by limiting your own franchise.
Wow, that tool sounds amazing and like something that might come in very handy even for hospice workers and chaplains who are working with people at the end of life on forgiveness, for them to be able to access that.
It very definitely is. And, you know, we have provided this to a number of hospice centers and continue to do so. It makes a huge difference to be able to square with yourself that you hold no grudges, that you're not angry with anyone, that you've done the best that you could do given the circumstances, and that you're prepared now to make the next step. That is a huge psychological adjustment for anyone and everyone, whether it is you're in the prison and you're looking to be freed from that form of incarceration, and or you're transitioning out of the physical into the next dimension.
Well, it's an important component of my book, What Really Matters, because for me, that's one thing I learned from my hospice patients. I saw every one of them struggle with forgiveness at the end of life and saw how much time they spent working on it, that it inspired me to decide, I'm going to do that work now. I'm starting right now. I don't want to hold on to anything. I want to let everything go as it comes to me and not hold grudges or resentments, as you say. And it is extremely powerful when you stop putting energy into resentment and free it up so you have it available for creativity.
Yes. I mean, a huge difference. You know, the work that you do, what you're doing right now, I think, you know, this is the kind of work that should be 101. You know, if we went to college, we should get it. If we went to high school, we should get it. Maybe it comes in our junior, senior year. But the whole idea that we fail to think about end of life until it's end of life is just a great mistake in our culture, great mistake. And I, you know, again, I cannot pass you enough kudos or accolades for what it is that you do or the stories that you share. The story that you just shared with me during this conversation about your mother, I guarantee you, is one that I will be sharing over and over again because, you know, her creativity to be in that place where there's nothing that you can do. And I have a friend kind of in that place right now, and an old dear friend. To be in that place where you want to do something but you feel you can't do, and then to realize, well, I can pray for other people, that is a very important message. You can do that as long as you have any consciousness whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's profound to consider that you're really not without options all the way up until the last breath, the last moment of consciousness.
And you never know, maybe the person you're praying for, you have a role in saving their life and they end up saving the world later on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's
never too late and it's never unimportant.
Mm-hmm. And that it's never too late idea is a great reminder for families, because I know I worked with a lot of families who maybe a relative was dying who was sort of the curmudgeon of the family or someone cantankerous, and they would all feel frustrated like, oh my goodness, this isn't going well, this person is going to have the worst time. But to remind them to keep putting out their positive energy, because it is never too late. Anyone can make a change at the last, and the more that person is surrounded by loving energy, the more possibility there is for that change to happen.
That is so very, very true, and I'm sure you've seen multiple instances of where you know, loved ones come to see someone, and the someone has the anger, has the angst, and the exchange intimidates their loved ones. Their loved ones don't want to upset them. On the other hand, they can't, you know, they can't really, they don't feel that they can approach him about changing that attitude. And so the result is, it hurts the loved ones. It hurts the survivors as much as it is painful for the person that is passing. In fact, maybe more so. Maybe it leaves an impression that lasts many, many, many years down the road, which is just another reason it's incumbent upon each of us to look at our lives and realize, you know, what is it that we want from ourselves when that time comes? Where do we want to be? And what must we do to get there? Listen, if you can buy life insurance, if you can write a grocery list for this weekend and start on it now because you just ran out of something, and so maybe like my wife, you have a list on your refrigerator. If you can forward think that far, certainly you can forward think to the inevitable. And that inevitable is when we're all going to transition from here. And if we just make a little tiny bit of an effort on a daily basis to begin to think about where we want to be when that time comes, it will change how we live right now. And that will, you know, empower us to make that transition easy and empower our loved ones at the same time to deal with it. You know, your mother gave you a great gift, I know that may sound strange, but it is such a great gift that she handed you, and you're sharing that and your gifts with everyone. I just think that's how I would like to hand it to my loved ones too.
Mm-hmm. And I can say even beyond that, it was really my mom's death was one of the inspirations for me to want to do this whole interview series, because I realized her death is probably somewhat uncommon in our country. She got to die at home and was peaceful and happy, and it really couldn't have been a more beautiful and profound experience. And I realized everyone needs to be thinking about this ahead of time, and I need to help spread the word. So, in a way, my mom's death was a gift to all the listeners out there who are hearing about this right now, because that it inspired me to want to put this series together.
Indeed, indeed, and I love it. And I love what you're doing. My banker, wonderful woman I've known for over 20 years, lost her mother a year ago, just after Thanksgiving. So it hasn't been quite a year. And her mother knew that, you know, she was coming to the end days. She was terminal. And her mother said to Janet, is the woman's name, said to Janet, I want to do something. I want to, you know, I want to help people. I've been helped so much in my life. You know, I want to do something with the time that I have remaining. So they decided that they were going to feed the homeless. And there's an area where I live where the homeless gather under this bridge, and it kind of provides shelter, and law enforcement looks generally the other way. And so they started going down under this bridge and feeding this the homeless. And her mother passed away, like I say, and it's not quite a year. And I happened to see Janet just yesterday. I took her in a check. I'm a selfish sucker by giving them a donation. I got some good neurochemicals, see. I took her in a check to help them do this big feed at Thanksgiving that they're going to do under the bridge. And, you know, tears just flowed from her eyes. And she said to me, she has made this a major cause since her mother has passed away. She's created a nonprofit corporation. Her bank is a supporter of it. A lot of, you know, local merchants support it. And she said to me, you know, I'm down there feeding him, Eldon, and my mother's right alongside me.
Aww.
You know, what you're doing, your mama's sitting there right alongside you. I just love it.
That's so beautiful. Eldon, you are just so, you're so full of wisdom and knowledge and experience, and it's such a blessing to all of us to get to just to learn from you and to hear what you have to share. And I'm so grateful to you for being willing to do that.
It's indeed been my pleasure to share with you, and I'll tell you what, and I mean this very sincerely, if I ever have a hospice need, I definitely want you to be the one that's there.
Oh, well, thank you. And I would be honored to be the one who was called. So, Eldon, one last time, I can't thank you enough for this gift you've given to all of us by sharing your stories and information with us. And I will put a link to your website so everyone can access that forgive and let go practice that you have available.
Great. And again, I mean it, Karen, it's been my pleasure. It's a wonderful thing that you're doing and a wonderful opportunity that you made available to me. And I genuinely mean that. It's been my honor and my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eldon, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.